May it please the Court. I'd like to first turn to the 1118 appeal and the proper construction of plate-like, and I'd like to briefly address two points. First, the Board committed reversible legal error by initially construing plate-like to mean generally flat, but later using a different construction when it considered the prior art. Second, even if the Court were to find no claim construction error, reversal is still warranted because there is no substantial evidence supporting the Board's determination.
Can I ask you just a housekeeping question, which is, this is the 532 patent, right?
It is.
If we were to hypothetically agree with you on the claim construction point, is there more work to be done by the Board, or does that end the appeal? End the case.
Thank you for asking. I believe there is additional work that would need to be done.
This is in terms of actually determining the
additional
work in the
additional
obvious.
Okay.
Let me ask you then, moving on the merits of that question. I got a lot of paper here, and there are a lot of words. What was the patent owner's construction? The Board didn't. It's very confusing, and we get a lot of cases under O2 Micro where parties complain that the Board changed its construction and applying it, whatever. But I was trying to compare your construction, what the Board did, and then what the patent owner was arguing for. It's a little ambiguous to me.
Sure. Let me see if I can give you a little background. The patent owner's construction was a flat, broad interface to adjacent bone portions. And there was a debate during trial as to whether or not either party's constructions were confined to a surface or a three-dimensional object. And the debate was had. And ultimately, the Board rejected the patent owner's claim construction, finding that it was limited to a surface, and adopted certain.
But it seemed like, and I'll ask the patent owner's counsel to explain it too, it seemed like even under their construction, that would be consistent with yours in terms of looking at the flat surface, simply at the ability to, I think they use these words, the ability to interface at the top and at the bottom, which I thought was kind of this, along the same lines as you had for the horizontal stuff.
The horizontal orientation. And that's a very good question, Your Honor. I think the key is that when you look at the patent owner's construction, it refers to one interface, not two. And so it's a flat, broad interface, a singular interface. And that's what the Board said. It seems to be confined to a surface. And that's why they rejected it. That's why we interpret they rejected it.
Yeah. Just one quick question, just so time doesn't run out. I understand, a major portion of your argument involves Claim 4. Are there any figures there are a lot of figures in this patent. Are there any figures that you want to call out in support of your construction?
Yes, Your Honor. In support of my construction. Well, I think, and the Board found that our construction was supported by the figures. They are generally flat in a horizontal orientation, which is the orientation of implant for these spinal implants. Mm-hmm. And then the Board, when it came to looking at the prior art, Your Honor, focused on, when considering the Grooms and Paul prior art references, looked at curves and legs in the vertical orientation and said, well, that takes it outside the scope of plate-like. And so we said, well, that's not correct. The mere presence of curves can't take a bone portion outside the scope of plate-like. And we know that because Claim 4, the claim that Your Honor referenced, recites a series of graft
no,
shapes.
Okay. I take your argument.
That's fine.
Can we move on to the second patent? I'm sorry.
The 158?
Yeah. If that's okay with my colleagues. Because I'm construing this, your argument, kind of two pieces. The first piece being Walter and the one graph versus the other. And then the second one seems to be the screw versus the pin. And I must tell you candidly, so you can help me out here, I'm having a hard time on the second portion. I take your arguments on the first portion and the Board's analysis. But on the second portion, it seems to me like based on a substantial evidence review, how can there not be substantial evidence to support the construction that the two were really different and there was not a reasonable expectation of success that you could use the screw, that the pin would work as easily as the screw did in this context?
Well, taking up the issue of substantial evidence on the bone pin, and you are correct, Your Honor, we must prevail on both issues.
Yes.
So focusing on the bone pin, I think one of the biggest problems there is there is not substantial evidence supporting the idea that there was no reasonable expectation of success because the evidence on which the board focused was the wrong person at the wrong place. And what I mean by that is this. When it came to evaluating, we're looking at the fact evidence, the testimony of LifeNet's fact witness, Mr. Gaskins, was limited to his personal experience. And he did not testify from the perspective of a person of ordinary skill and their reasonable expectation of success in using a bone pin, either as described in the Grooms or Paul references, or in the prior art summarized in the patent itself, with an iliac crest. And that's summarized at Appendix 4763 through 4781 in our reply brief at page 52. So he was the wrong person. He never testified from the perspective of a person of skill. So there's lacking of evidence there. And then secondly, I mentioned that the board focused on the wrong place. The testimony of LifeNet's surgeon expert, Dr. Shaffrey, was confined to making grafts in the operating room and not making grafts in advance of surgery in the lab, which is how allografts are made. They're made in advance. And what you do is if you're going to have a bone pin, you harvest it from the cadaver and you harvest the iliac crest or some other bone from the cadaver and you assemble it in a lab well in advance of surgery. You don't have the concerns of the time pressures and that type of thing in surgery. And that's mentioned at page 66 through 68 of our brief and also 49 through 50 of our reply brief. And so I don't feel that there is substantial evidence supporting the board's determination. We also addressed that
the board did analyze, and I'm looking at the wrong thing, appendix 30 through 32. I do, again, it's substantial evidence review. There were several experts. And ultimately, the board was crediting one expert over the other. And I thought, the board is saying at A32 that they're crediting Dr. Shaffrey, and they are talking about an allograft bone, which is outside, right? And I guess if you want to look at the testimony and tell me where we can find error.
Appendix A32, Your Honor?
I'm looking at, the analysis on this issue is 30 through 33, and the board cites a lot of competing testimony by the witnesses and credits what one witness says over another. And if your only answer to Dr. Shaffrey was, he wasn't testifying as a person skilled in the art, I don't know how we do that.
I want to be clear. Dr. Shaffrey was testifying. The testimony, if you look at his declaration, and we summarize it in our reply brief, we lay it out for the court. He's testifying about what's happening if a surgeon is trying to make that graft on the fly in the operating room. And that's not what we argued. What we argued was that it would be made in advance out of allogeneic bone. And it was Mr. Gaskins who we said did not testify as a person of skill in the art. He was a fact witness who testified about his own personal experience at LifeNet making bone pins, and his testimony was confined to his personal experience and the difficulties he had, but he never testified as to what a person of skill's reasonable expectations of success would be, given the teachings in the art, the admissions in the patent about no undue experimentation for bone pins. Did I answer your Honor's question?
Sure, I take your point.
Mr. Turner, let me ask you just to bounce back for a second to the 532 patent. Does it make much difference to you in terms of assessing your argument, whether one looks at it as an error of claim construction or the correct claim construction but a misapplication of that construction.
Your Honor, I noticed, by the way, I've made it to my rebuttal time. Is it okay if I answer your question?
Oh, yes, sir.
Okay, I'm sure it would be. So, does it make any difference? I don't think so, because, first, I mean, it's two sides of the same coin. The board said generally flat and nothing else. And so, even under the substantial evidence, it was undisputed that the Grooms and Paul references were horizontally, generally flat in the horizontal plane. So you get it that way. As to what the construction that the court applied, the construction that it applied was inconsistent with the evidence. And specifically, I mentioned the claim four.
Which, well, it matters because it matters. It affects the standard of review.
It does.
So is it your view? I mean, I really haven't thought through the answer to this question. Is de novo, obviously we all know de novo reviews applies to claim construction. In terms of the application of the claim construction, is that de novo review because we're still talking about claim construction, or is there substantial evidence review to that question?
Well, all right, that's a very good question. I want to be clear, and we did cite the Corning and Vitamix cases, which talked about the difference between the effective construction and what was construed earlier, the original construction and then what was actually applied. In that case, I do believe that the court is entitled to review it de novo and say, no, you got it wrong. When it came time to applying the construction of the prior art, you used a different construction, and we get to review that de novo. But as to the actual application in the end, of course, that is a fact finding.
Sorry, I interrupted your question.
No, I'm all finished.
Okay, all right. We'll hear from the other side, and we'll save your rebuttal and cross-appeal time.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Polly, thanks. I wasn't used to seeing you there. It's usually good.
Mr. Galuzzo.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court. The Board agreed with Surgiline that plate-like should mean generally flat. The board then applied that same construction to the prior art, exactly how Surgiline said to apply it.
So what was another way of saying what the, isn't another way of saying the construction that the board ultimately applied said generally flat means it has to be flat in the horizontal and the vertical?
Your Honor,
is that a fair application of the construction?
Surgiline is the one who proposed the construction, and what Surgiline told the board...
No, I want to know what you think... I'm sorry to interrupt, but I want to know what you think the board was saying when they were giving further definition to generally flat. What were they saying with respect to vertical and horizontal?
The board wasn't giving further definition to generally flat. The board was applying the proposed construction from Surgiline that generally flat must be evaluated when looking at the overall shape of the bone portion.
So let's talk about, what does that mean? Does that mean it has to be looking at the overall, meaning that both the vertical and the horizontal planes have to be flat? Is that the way you construed the claim construction and the board construed it? Is that fair?
Your Honor, the way that we understand the board's construction and application of it is the same way that Surgiline proposed it be done at Appendix 2234 to 35 during oral argument, that you don't just look at one place or one area or one side of the cortical bone piece to see whether it's generally flat. You have to look at all aspects of it, all sides of it. And of course, the construction isn't flat. The construction is generally flat. So you have to have some, of course, wiggle room there, so to speak. And so if the bone pieces, when looked at from all aspects, on balance are generally flat, then they are generally flat.
How does that coincide with Claim 4?
Claim 4 relates to the overall structure of the composite bone graft, which is made up of three plate-like bone portions. And we know from the specification and from the figures and from Claim 4 that, of course, plate-like can allow some curvature. For example, on the embodiments that have a cylindrical disc as a plate-like cortical bone portion, we know that that can allow some curvature because the cylindrical disc is like a plate. It is generally flat. Or in the flattened curved wedge, for example, that the two outer cortical bone portions can have curvature on their outsides and, as we proposed, a flat broad interface to the adjacent and interior cancellous bone portion, or under the board's construction, that it is still generally flat because on balance, the bone portion, when looked at from all aspects, as Surgiline proposed the board to do, and as the board said it did at Appendix 139 for Grooms and 144 for Paul, it looks at the overall shape of the bone portion, not merely whether they include a region that is generally flat.
Mr. Gould, the one question I have, I've been scratching my head a little bit about, the construction was generally flat. What does the word generally in that setting impart, in your view?
The word generally, as far as we understand, of course, Surgiline proposed the construction, we proposed something else. As we understand, it imparts some flexibility that doesn't require exact flatness. It doesn't require a plank, for example, which is one of the embodiments discussed in the specification. So it doesn't require a 2x4 style. There does allow some flexibility where a graft can have some curvature, a bone portion can have some curvature, and still be considered generally flat because that's what the specification tells us.
Okay. Thank you.
Surgiline appeals this issue, though, not because the board applied a different construction. In fact, as we've talked about at Appendix 139 to 40 and 144, the board applied the exact construction that they adopted and that Surgiline proposed. And substantial evidence shows that the prior art Grooms and Paul have significant irregularities that make them not plate-like under any reasonable construction of the term, whether the one the board adopted, whether the one LifeNet proposed, or if the court reaches the de novo issue, which we don't think the court should, something else the court may come up with here. On Walter, as Judge Prost...
Well, let me ask you, just to finish that up, but the first question I think I asked your friend was if we agree with his construction of whatever. If he prevails on the claim construction dispute, he acknowledged that it would still have to be sent back for further review for the ultimate question of obviousness. I assume you agree with that.
Yes, Your Honor, though because Surgiline is the one who proposed the construction before the board and prevailed on that issue, under the Key Pharmaceuticals case, 161 F3rd at 715, that's not actually an issue that's before this court. What's before this court is a substantial evidence review of a comparison of the claim language and its construction to the prior art. And Graham tells us that that is what the comparison is. That is one of the factual findings underlying obviousness analysis, comparison of the claims to the prior art. And substantial evidence supports the board's factual finding that neither Grooms nor Paul have plate-like cortical bone portions, and those figures can be seen on Appendix 139. For Grooms, we have to, of course, consider one of those individual bone portions and whether it's plate-like. So is 801A shown on Appendix 139 on its own plate-like? The board said it is not, and the board gives reasons why. At Appendix 139, while it has a generally flat base, and the board did acknowledge that, it has legs or curved portions that extend
so
away from...
So when the board said it has a generally flat base, I'm looking at Figure 8A on Page 139, that's what you're referring to. What was it terming the base? Was it, I mean, in other words, hold this up here. Was it talking about this part down here? In other words, it's facing down towards the Figure 8A. Is that the base right there?
Since the board states that the legs or curved portions extend away from the base, My understanding of the board's analysis is that the generally flat base would be the side that you can't see on the perspective view on the left. So what would be the outer portion when inserted into the spine? Okay. And the critical part here is that these legs or curved portions, these irregularities, cause this cortical bone portion not to be plate-like because it creates the canal. It creates the canal between the two cortical bone portions. And this makes Grooms and Paul both a ring-like style graft. with a ring of cortical bone that surrounds an inner canal of cancellous or spongy bone. And these mimic a cross-section of long bone like a femur from your leg.
So let me ask you, though, what is the significance in your view? It appears from looking at that figure that what I'll call the top and the bottom are both flat. How does that, and I'm talking about the part that's up here, the top of the little C, and also what would be the bottom underneath that we can't see. Those seem to be flat. Why does that not support what the board did here?
Your Honor, a non-plate-like or non-generally flat bone portion like these can have flat regions.
Excuse me, why does that not support Mr. Hedrick's argument? It seems to be flat on the top and flat on the bottom.
Granted, it does have flat portions, and the board recognized that it does have flat areas. But on balance, when you look at 801A from all sides and all angles, as Serge Align told the board to do, it is not generally flat. And the reason being that because they replicate that cross-section of long bone, that's the prior art design that LifeNet's patents were trying to get away from. And as the patents tell us, for example, at Appendix 267, Column 1, lines 59 to column 2, line 12, these grafts in the prior art often failed because they extruded, they slipped, they were not cellularized, and they failed mechanically. LifeNet's patents got beyond that design by optimizing the trade-off between strong cortical bone that supports the weight of the spine and the spongy cancellous bone that allows for the ingrowth and fusion for a successful surgery. Essentially, this plate-like design allowed for greater stability using less cortical bone to maximize the amount of cancellous bone in the given space of the spinal column. Dr. Shaffrey testifies at Appendix 4737 to 38 that this facilitates a flush fit that promotes mechanical stability and load distribution across the entire graft. Grooms and Paul are nothing like this.
Can we move to the... unless my colleagues obviously have questions, can we move to the other patent and the question? I mean, we were discussing with your friend what I found a hard issue in this case, which is the pin versus the metal screw. And I'm looking at page appendix 32 of the board's opinion. I think, maybe I don't understand this all correctly, but I think their answer to the fact that there would have been problems with Walter because that was an autograph, their response was, well, yeah, but that's because you're doing, if you do it outside the body in an allograft,
yes, right,
that alleviates most of the concerns that one has expressed and your witnesses professed for doing it inside the body. And what the board says about that is that, no, what Dr. Shaffrey said was fine, because even though most of his declaration was about autograft bone, he had a statement at the end that said, everything I said before applies to this as well. Right?
Yes, Your Honor.
Isn't that a little sketchy, maybe? I mean, for an expert to testify in detail about one thing and then at the end summarily or conclusively say, and yeah, in another circumstance, everything I said applies as well. Is that a little problematic, even under a substantial evidence review?
No, Your Honor, it's not, because that's not the limit of Dr. Shaffer's testimony. First, he's a person of skill in the art under the definition that Serge Align proposed and the board adopted at Appendix 102 to 03. But that's not the only testimony from Dr. Shaffrey about his experience and knowledge about allografts, how they're created, and how the bone pin would be used in conjunction with them. He testifies about allografts based not only on his personal experience as a surgeon of over 30 years, but his review of industry literature, and we can see
this. No, I appreciate that. But if he has a declaration, and I don't have the declaration in front of me, so I don't remember all of the details, but if most of his declaration deals with the problems of autograft, what does he say with respect to allograft? He just says these problems are also the same, right? I mean, is that not kind of conclusory?
No, Your Honor, it's not, again, for the same reasons that he has the background knowledge of allografts based on his experience and review of the literature. But the board didn't just rely on Shaffrey. The board also relied significantly in the bone pin discussion on Mr. Gaskins, a technician who was there at the very beginning, the invention of the LifeNet patents, and has over 20 years of experience creating, machining these bone pins and allografts in the tissue bank. And his testimony is from between Appendix 4770 and 74-ish. Now, Your Honor, I do want to make sure that I address my cross-appeal in this portion of my argument time before sitting down. So let's start briefly with first principles, that the specification is the single best guide to the meaning of a disputed term. This is not a case where a party is trying to improperly limit the claim to a preferred embodiment. Instead, the LifeNet patents, both of them, since they share a common specification, implicitly define disposed between by its repeated, consistent, and exclusive use of disposed between to require complete separation. The 158 patent doesn't change that. Disposed between and not in physical contact in the same claim can be understood in harmony to both require complete separation because those two terms, like in the Bancorp case, are used from different perspectives, referring to different materials to get to the same structural result. If the Your Honors have no further questions, I'll reserve the remainder of my time for rebuttal.
Okay, I think we're okay, and we'll leave you some rebuttal time in your cross appeal.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Mr. Hedrick.
My time's 3:05. Then I'm going to confine myself briefly on the cross appeal and then a few points on the 1118 appeal. On the cross appeal, this is not an implicit redefinition case, and LifeNet knew how to claim completely separate when it wanted to, as shown by the not in physical contact language of Claim 1 and 2 of the earlier issued 158 patent. And I think in the cross-appeal, the most important thing we have to remember is that the board found that the ordinary meaning of disposed between does not require complete separation of the surrounding structure. That's at Appendix 114, and LifeNet did not challenge that. Instead, they are arguing a special and narrower meaning of arranged to completely separate, which they admit is not aligned with the ordinary meaning. Now, as far as implicit redefinition goes, they waited until the reply brief to cite any case law on that point. I'll just briefly address it while I can, and that is, we know that if there's going to be any implicit redefinition, it must be clear from the specification. We cited Thorner and MBO Labs, and of course Phillips tells us that you must have a clear redefinition. Their cases are all distinguishable. I don't have time to handle them all, but I will say this, that none of them involve a second patent with uses a related patent, substantially same specification, recites the exact same claim term, and additional language that would be rendered surplusage if the advocated construction were adopted. And then on the, I think I'm going to leave it on that, and I will turn back to the 1118 plate-like appeal, if I may. I heard a number of questions. Judge Prost, you asked me for some figures that might support construction of plate-like. There are a variety of figures in the patent, but I would refer Your Honor to figures 14 and 34, which show plate-like structures that have curves on them. They are generally flat in the horizontal orientation, the orientation of implant. Also, I think critical to consider is the Janssen reference, which was the prior art reference that we cited as extrinsic evidence as the meaning of plate-like. It's the only objective contemporaneous evidence of what actually a patent that actually uses the term plate-like and shows us what it means. And what does it show us? It shows us C-shaped implants for use in the spine that are generally flat in the horizontal and vertical, in the horizontal orientation. And that C shape is important because that's what the board pointed to when they said Grooms and Paul fell outside of plate-like. Council mentioned the maximization of surface area and that the alleged invention provides for this. That's not in the claims. That's not an element of the claims. And then also council mentioned the overall shape and sometimes called it the all aspects or all sides and angles. That's not correct. The board's construction is generally flat, no other limitations. Unless Your Honors have any other questions, I am done.
No questions. Okay. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. And Mr. Galuzzo, you've got the last word. Just on the cross appeal, please.
you. Your Honors, as I was stating on our cross appeal, LifeNet's patents implicitly define disposed between by its repeated, consistent, and exclusive use of disposed between in the specification and in the figures of both patents to require complete separation. And what emphasizes and reinforces that implicit definition is that when there are structures that are not physically separated, the patents use different terms. They use terms like disposed in, disposed through, channel, canal, and through hole. It is very clear from the specifications of both patents that this is an implicit redefinition case. And as I said, the claims of the 158 patent using both disposed between and not in physical contact can be understood in harmony to both require the same structure, just like in the Bancorp case, which is properly applied to the claims of the 158 patent. In that case, the court had to grapple with whether two claim terms in close proximity in the independent claims could mean the same thing. The court correctly found they did. That's the analysis the court should apply here. We respectfully request that the court affirm the decision as to Grooms, Paul, and Walter, and reverse as to disposed between in claims 12 to 21 of the 532 patent.
Anything else? Okay. Thank you. Thanks to both counsel. Case is taken under submission.